This is Phil Farron. And I am driving to the hospital because my mom, at some point Tuesday night, unfortunately, we don't know when, my mom fell down and broke her hip, which is not completely unexpected at this time of life, but you know, it's always sad. My dad called us at about midnight Wednesday, early Wednesday morning. And he said that mom had fallen down and he couldn't get her back up and they were trying and she was saying that, you know, every time they tried that her leg was hurting. My mom is tough. She, I don't know if her pain sensors just don't work or what. But I said, well, Dad, when you got out there, what? Oh, she was just sitting there. So I wasn't sure she was actually hurt at first. And I said, well, you know, I'll come over. Give me a minute. Lynette hollered from the bedroom. She said, just call Maranatha. So I did. I called Maranatha and they sent a nurse down and the head of security went down there and, you know, started to move her, and mom was wincing and they were saying, okay, wait. And so then they called the ambulance, and then mom didn't want to go to the hospital. And, you know, the little ambulance person said, well, you know, I have the authority. I'm going to be very diplomatic about this, but this is going to happen. Later, my dad, as the ambulance took off and as I was getting the cards from him for insurance and all that kind of stuff, he said, well, I think if we could have just gotten her up and gotten in bed, she would have been fine. I said, Bob, if she has a broken hip, she's not going to be fine. So we got everybody bundled up and gone, and that was the start of a saga. So on Wednesday, I was up at midnight, and I got to bed at 10 o'clock that day. It was fast day, so I didn't really eat anything. Had a few pieces of gum, but that was it. And in that stretch of time, I think I ended up at about 2 or 3 hours of sleep, so that was a long day. But they did the surgery, worked her in, got her into surgery. You know, she seemed to come through that fine. I was reading up on everything, you know, because I knew we were going to have to make this decision. You can make the decision to just go home. It's not advisable, but you can. But what happens in that case is that hospice basically will just load the person up with painkillers and they'll just lay in bed because they won't be able to move. And, you know, they'll just wait till they die, which will happen because you'll get blood clots and just lay in bed, you know, you won't. So, talked mom into going ahead and having the surgery. But she, you know, seems to be recovering from it. She seems to be doing okay. They're trying to get her up at this point, get her moving around. And then from there, once she gets released from the hospital, they'll take her into rehabilitation. So Maranatha does have a rehabilitation clinic. We're going to try to just get her in there, because then she'll be close to Dad. So I'm heading down there. Lynette was down there. I was down there pretty much all day Wednesday. Lynette was down there today. And then I'm planning on getting grocery shopping done early and then running down there and being with her pretty much the rest of the day. So, because I can sit and write, and I can just put in my headphones and she sleeps and I write, you know, so we're good. And I'm in kind of an easy spot right now in the book. I don't think I'm going to have any trouble getting my words in tonight. Although, I'm not really sure what comes next. So we'll see. I'm just looking ahead here, and everyone is backed up, and some people are turning around a bad. It must have been an accident. Looks like there was an accident. Some people just went around the whole thing. But as long as I'm not committed to this path, I think I will abandon this route and find another route. Yeah, there's a police. Something must have happened with the train. There's a train crossing down there, and the thingy is down, and nothing is happening. So there must have been a problem with the train. But anyway, so that was our excitement this week. As you can hear, it's raining. We just had a tornado warning come through a little bit ago. We are in that season, so it always gets exciting. But right now, everything's kind of clearing up. Oh, excuse me. So it's good. Writing on the book is going fine. Things are puttering along. I think I'm on chapter 11. The goal is to be... See, the goal would be to chapter 15. And I don't think there's going to be any problem with that. Before I break to actually put out the production version of book 6. So, there were enough interesting things going on this week. I was running the plans for, okay, if everything just completely goes south here... how am I going to handle this? And I was thinking, well, if I just completely lose this week of writing, I could delay the production version of book 6. I was figuring it all out. You know, I could go ahead and keep writing on this book and just take a couple of hours each evening, maybe, and just slowly put out book 6. But thankfully at this point, so far, I've been able to hold and keep moving with this book. So that's going to be the plan. It's interesting. I was thinking about this the other day. If I actually stay on schedule, it is highly probable, since I won't be finished with this series for another 8 years, it is highly probable that I will have written this series through the death of my father-in-law, my mother-in-law, my mom, and my dad. All four of them. Although Nana is in, she's in pretty good health. And I think she's just in her mid-80s. So 8 years. 8 years. That's possible. You know, I think her mom lived quite long, but my mom and dad, probably not. That would put my mom at 98, and I don't think anyone in her family has lived that long, and that would put my dad at 102, and nobody in his family has lived anywhere near that long. His mom died at 72, so he's definitely an outlier. So it'll be interesting to see if I can keep this pace through all of that, and I'm sure there will be other crises that will come along in the midst of all this, but you know, we'll just keep puttering along. So that's good. Work is good. We had one of those heartbreaking complications right at the last minute with the new paperless AER form that I was working on. Everything's up. It's ready to go. It's all fine. And then we get talking about the from address on the notifications, and we're still talking about it a week later. And it looks like we'll still be talking about it into the beginning part of next week. And it was just, we had to get some opinions from different quarters, and some of those weren't available, and that happens. It happens. But we're gonna, I'm just keep pushing it. You know? And Monday we have a meeting. Maybe we'll be able to get this resolved on Monday. If we can, we can move forward. So it's fine. Anyways, so I had actually put together some notes for last week already. And then I just got to jabbering last week about what? Oh, getting my car out of the mud. That's right. I have got my car out. Yes. So in the, in the process of doing all that, I talked all the way home. And so I thought, well, I need a longer amount of time in order to do this justice, because I found this TED Talk. This TED Talk, How to Exploit Democracy. This fascinated me. This TED Talk fascinated me. And it was interesting because I started listening to it and I thought it was going one place and then it kind of went someplace else. And then I was thinking about what actually was being said and I thought, what? You know, there is a quote that's attributed to Thomas Jefferson. And it's something like, wherever the people are well-educated, you know, they have earned the right to their own government, something like that. It's now, I was trying to back that up and actually see that, yes, that was a real, real quote. Oh, no, it's whenever, supposedly the quote is, whenever the people are well-informed, they can be trusted with their own government. And this TED Talk was really about that. But the more I started thinking about it and looking at it, it's about more than that. And interestingly enough, possibly even fairly insidious. It's really interesting. So the TED Talk was called How to Exploit Democracy. And it's by a person, Laura Galante. I looked her up, and she's been the head of some think tanks, or she's been involved with a bunch of different think tanks. Wow, there's traffic down here, too. What is going on? I looped over thinking, oh, I can get by, but there's a little bit of traffic down here on National. Oh, well, we're in it now. So she's been the head of some things, and I mean, this is not a naive person. They've been watching, you know, hacker attacks and those kind of things and tracking them and trying to figure things out. And so this is from her perspective, but the longer she talked, the more I thought, wait, what? What is she really saying? So we'll just wander our way through her notes and then see what we end up with. So she started off saying, okay, let's say that you despise Western democracy. Democracy in all its trappings, free elections, town halls, endless debates about the proper role of government, too messy, too unpredictable, too constraining for your taste. And the way these democracies band together and lecture everyone else about individual rights and freedoms, it gets under your skin. So what do you do about it? You can call out the hypocrisy and failures of Western democracies and explain how your way is better, but that's never really worked for you. What if you could get the people whose support is the very foundation of these democracies to start questioning the system? Okay. Just as a side note here, I know a whole lot of people in America who question the system. So, there you go. Make the idea occur in their own minds that democracy and its institutions are failing them, their elite are corrupt puppet masters, and the country they knew is in a free fall. To do that, you need to infiltrate the information spheres of these democracies. You'll need to turn their most powerful asset, an open mind, into their greatest vulnerabilities. You'll need to question the truth. The truth. Now, that's an important word. It becomes very important later for her. The truth. Remember that word. But, again, going back to the possibly fallacious quote by Thomas Jefferson, wherever people are well informed, they can be trusted with their government. Well informed. That's important. So, the real treasure of an open democracy is not necessarily an open mind. It's well informed. It's understanding what the facts are, understanding what the truth is. Although facts and truth are loaded words, as we shall see later. She said, now you'll be familiar with the hacking and leaks that happened in 2016. One was the Democratic National Committee's networks and the personal email accounts of its staff later released on WikiLeaks. The media took the bait. Well, she says before that. After that, various online personas, like a supposed Romanian cyber criminal who didn't speak Romanian, aggressively pushed news of these leaks to journalists. The media took the bait. They were consumed by how much the DNC hated Bernie. At the time, it was that narrative that far outshined the news that a group of Russian government-sponsored hackers, who we called Advanced Persistent Threat 28, or ATP-28 for short, was carrying out these operations against the United States. So, according to her, the hacking of the DNC, and the personal email accounts of its staff were actually carried out by this group, and in fact, this group was aggressively pushing the story of this hacking and leaks to journalists. She says there's no shortage of evidence of this. The group of Russian hackers hadn't just appeared out of nowhere. We started tracking the group back in 2014. And the tools that ATP-28 used to compromise its victims' networks demonstrated a thoughtful, well-resourced effort that had taken place for over a decade in Moscow's time zone from about 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. ATB-28 loved to prey on emails and contacts of journalists in Chechnya, the Georgian government, Eastern European defense attachés, all targets with undeniable interest to the Russian government. Okay? We weren't the only ones onto this. Governments, research teams across the world were coming to similar conclusions, observing the same types of operations. But what Russia was doing in 2016 went far beyond espionage. The DNC hack was just one of many where stolen data was posted online, accompanied by a sensational narrative, and then amplified in social media for lightning speed adoption by the media. This didn't ring the alarm bells that a nation state was trying to interfere with the credibility of another's internal affairs. Okay, so there, that's fine. So collectively, why did we not see this coming? So supposedly, the Obama, why did it take months? Supposedly, the Obama administration is caught in a perfect catch-22. By raising the specter that the Russian government was interfering with the U.S. presidential campaign, the administration was appearing to meddle in the campaign itself. She said, but the better answer, I think, is that the U.S. and the West were utterly unequipped to recognize and respond to the modern information operation, despite the fact that the U.S. had wielded information with devastating success in an era not so long ago. So I'm not sure I agree with her conclusion here, but she thinks that the U.S. government did not recognize how successful this type of hacking could be, because it's not just the hacking and getting the information, it's then taking the information and leveraging it, getting it into social media so that you can sway people's opinions. All right. She says, look, so while the U.S. and the West spent the last 20 years caught up in cybersecurity, what networks to harden, what infrastructures deemed critical, how to set up armies of cyber warriors and cyber commands. Whoa, someone almost pulled that in front of me there. Yay. Russia was thinking in far more consequential terms. Okay, according to her, before the first iPhone itself hit the shelf, the Russian government understood the risk and the opportunity that technology provided and the intercommunication and instant communication it provided us. Okay, I don't know what she based that on or how she got that fact. It would be very interesting to see if she actually had some quotes from the internal groups or if this is just speculation on her part. Because that would be really interesting to see. She says, our realities are increasingly based on the information that we're consuming at the palm of our hands and from the news feeds that we're scanning and the hashtags and the stories we see trending. The Russian government was the first to recognize how this evolution had turned your mind into the most old it. Oh, okay, it's over there. I have a sirens going by. Had turned your mind into the most exploitable device on the planet. And your mind is particularly exploitable if you're accustomed to the unfettered flow of information, now increasingly curated to your own taste. The panorama of information that's so interesting to you gives a state, anyone for that matter, a perfect backdoor to your mind.
Okay.
Well, a well-informed electorate, you know, it can be trusted with their own government, but if you're not well-informed, yeah, that's a problem. So she says it's this new brand of state-sponsored information operations that can be much more successful, more insidious, and harder for the target audience that includes the media to decipher and characterize. Okay, so what we're saying is that if you can grab a bunch of information, that you can use it to manipulate people and get done what you want to get done. That's what she's saying. And that's supposedly what the Russian government did, and that's why they were so successful in affecting the campaign. In other words, this is why Hillary didn't win. Okay? Because it was the Russians that convinced us that Hillary was not the person for the presidency. Okay. So, having said that, so we say, if you can get a hashtag trending on Twitter and chum the waters with fake news directed to audience primed to receive it, drive journalists to dissect terabytes of email for a scent of impropriety, all tactics used in Russian operations, then you've got a shot at effectively camouflaging your operations in the mind of your target. This is what Russia's long called reflexive control. It's the ability to use information on someone else so that they make a decision on their own accord that's favorable to you. This is the nation state grade image control and perception management, and it's conducted by any means with any tools, network-based or otherwise, that will achieve it. Okay, she said, take this for another example. In February 2014, a few weeks before Russia would invade Crimea, a phone call is posted on YouTube. In it, there are two U.S. diplomats. They sound like they're playing kingmaker in Ukraine, or worse, they curse the EU for its lack of speed and leadership in resolving the crisis. The media covers the phone call, and then the ensuing diplomatic backlash leaves Washington and Europe reeling. Okay. But nowhere in this does anybody say anything about the fact that the phone call wasn't real. Remember, facts and truth. That's what we're talking about. So while hacked phone calls and emails and networks keep grabbing the headlines, the real operations are the ones that are influencing the decisions you make and the opinions you hold, all in the service of the nation state strategic interests. This is the power of the information age. This information is all that much more seductive, all that much easier to take at value and pass on when it's authentic. Who's not interested in the truth that's presented in phone calls and emails that were never intended for public consumption? But how meaningful is that truth if you don't know why it's being revealed to you? What? Wait a minute. Okay, so yeah. Somebody gets this phone call where people are saying things that they shouldn't be saying. Like the DNC hates Bernie. That is a fact. The DNC is actually helping Hillary Clinton trying to help her defeat Bernie. That is a fact. So if hackers then grab that fact and expose it, are we saying, well, we shouldn't listen to that fact because we should figure out if that fact is being revealed to us by someone who has an ulterior motive? So if it's being revealed to us because someone doesn't want Hillary in the White House, then maybe we should just ignore that. Because she says it's all the more seductive, then that much easier to take at face value and pass on when it's authentic. Okay. So she says, we must recognize that this place we are living in, which we've quaintly termed cyberspace, isn't defined by ones and zeros, but by information and the people behind it. This is far more than a network of computers and devices. This is a network composed of minds interacting with computers and devices. And for this network, there's no encryption, no firewall, no two-factor authentication, no password complex enough to protect you. What you have for defense is far stronger. It's more adaptable. It's always running the latest version. It's the ability to think critically, to call out falsehood and press for the facts. Well, no one ever denied that those emails, as far as I know, that were saying how much the DNC hated Bernie were false. No one ever denied all the stuff that was revealed about the Clinton Foundation was false. No one's, they were facts. They were hidden. And finally, she says, and above all else, you must have the courage to unflinchingly pursue the truth. But see, when she uses the term truth, what she's saying is, well, you have to understand their motivations. So even though it's facts, if they're trying to get you to believe a certain thing, then you should just not believe those facts. And you should just say, well, they're just bad-mouthing the Hillary campaign. They're just trying to make sure she doesn't get elected. So I'm just not going to listen to that. This is an interesting definition of truth. Because it's not truth as in what happened, it's truth as in how do I evaluate this so that I can keep doing what I want to do and ignore stuff that's inconvenient. I mean, in my mind, she's saying that people were tuned a certain way to accept these facts. But honestly, for me, I was really struggling with who I was going to vote for. But there were just some key things that when I hit them, I don't know if I've mentioned, I probably have mentioned these. When we hit all the Clinton Foundation stuff, you know, when we hit the abortion issue where Hillary Clinton was not even willing to say that in third trimester there shouldn't be some controls. When we hit the stuff with Bernie as to how underhanded the DNC was being, it was like, oh, done. done. Cannot support that for sure. So it's really interesting because this definition of truth, which I think we will see again, is going to be laden with intention. So it's not truth if someone has the wrong intentions. And the right intentions, are, of course, are going to be defined by people who just want to ignore things. It's fascinating. It will be fascinating to track through this and see where this ends up. Because if you're saying that facts don't add up to truth, but instead there's another something involved in it, like intention, then I don't really think you have truth. You've got this sliding situational ethics kind of truth that my truth is just whatever I decide at the moment, which sounds very familiar, because there are other areas of life where we're deciding that my truth is that what I decide at the moment. I've made it to the hospital. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it to where I was going.